turning point was 1967. It was in 1967, with the 1967 war, that U.S.-Israel relations were solidified in pretty much their current form, a big change from before, and a new framework was established in the region. So what happened in 67? Well, in the background was a war that was going on between radical Islamism and secular nationalism in the Arab world. The radical Islamism is centered in Saudi Arabia, the most extreme fundamentalist Arab state. Wahhabism, most extreme form of Islam, the supporters of jihad, the missionary movement, and so on. That's centered in Saudi Arabia. So that's radical Islam. But at that time, secular nationalism was centered in Egypt, Nasser's Egypt. There was a war going on between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, a kind of a proxy war in the Yemen, and it was serious. The United States and Britain have traditionally supported radical Islam, almost always. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan supported the formation of Hamas. It's very consistent. The U.S. has been a very strong, Britain too, a very strong supporter of radical Islamism. And there's a reason, because they consider it a barrier to secular nationalism. And secular nationalism is the real threat, not only in the Middle East, but everywhere. For example, secular nationalism might involve a move towards real independence and towards taking over the resources of the region and using them for its own population instead of for the West and for the ruling gangsters. And that's a threat. Very consistently, the U.S. and Britain have supported radical Islam, Israel too. In 67, Israel effectively destroyed secular nationalism. That was the main outcome of the war, and defended Saudi Arabia, defended radical Islam. So that was a big plus for U.S. policy, and relations with Israel changed almost totally at that time, militarily, diplomatically, ideologically, you know, all kinds of ways. Well, that continues, but after that, in 1970, the U.S.-backed dictatorship in Jordan was carrying out a real massacre of Palestinians. Black September was called. It looked for a while as though Syria might intervene to prevent the massacre. The U.S. was pretty upset about that. But the U.S. at the time was completely bogged down in Southeast Asia. It just invaded Cambodia. You know, things were totally impossible. It called on Israel to react. Israel mobilized its quite formidable military forces. Syria backed off. Now, that was considered a positive step in protecting the Hashemite monarchy and also the Saudi Arabian monarchy. And in fact, the U.S. aid to Israel practically quadrupled that year. And so it continued. Nixon was president then. There was a Nixon doctrine, so-called, and the Nixon doctrine was that the U.S. ought to have surrogate states carrying out the dirty work. Couldn't do everything by ourselves anymore. And in the Middle East, there had to be what were called cops on the beat. The cops on the beat who keep the place under control had to be non-Arab. They do a better job killing Arabs. So Pakistan, Iran, which was then under the Shah, Turkey, Israel, they're the cops on the beat. Police headquarters, of course, is in Washington, and there's a branch office in London. That's essentially the way you run the region. And Israel was joined as one of the cops on the beat at that time. And that's stayed pretty much like that. It became critical in 1971. It was one of the most important moments in Israel's history, I think. In 1971, the new president of Egypt, President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty. Nothing for the Palestinians. The quid pro quo was that Israel was to withdraw from Arab territory, and in fact, Egypt only cared about Egyptian territory, the occupied Sinai. Actually, Jordan came along a year later with a similar proposal, withdraw from the West Bank. Well, Israel had a choice at that point, a crucial choice, and they made a fateful decision, I think. They could have had almost total security. A peace treaty with Egypt and Jordan, nothing for the Palestinians, Syrians out of the game. That's essentially as much security as you can get in this world. And they had to decide, do we want security or do we want expansion? And they decided They'd rather have expansion than security. The question is, what would the U.S. do, as always? And the U.S. went along with them. Kissinger supported that. This is what he called stalemate in his memoirs. No negotiations, just force. Well, that had a lot of consequences. One consequence, it led to the 73 war, which was a very close thing for Israel. Since then, there's been an essentially permanent choice of accepting expansion over security. Israel could have security right now, accepting the international consensus, but they want expansion. And now it's primarily into the West Bank and the illegally annexed Golan Heights, which people don't talk about. The Security Council declared it illegal, but the U.S. didn't care, so Israel does it. And that remains the situation. Well, that was 71, 72. In January 1976, the major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, neighboring states, brought a resolution to the Security Council calling for a two-state settlement. By then, the Palestinian issue had reached the international agenda. So they called for a two-state settlement on the international border, the recognized international border, the so-called Green Line. And then the resolution added the standard wording of the major diplomatic documents, UN 242, recognition of the rights of every state in the region to live in peace and security within secure and recognized borders. It's basically the resolution. The U.S. vetoed a similar resolution in 1980. The Security Council's ruled out, shifted to the General Assembly, and then you get these annual votes with, 151-3 and so on, year after year. Meanwhile, settlement expansion continued. And the Oslo agreements came along in 1993. It was a total disaster for the Palestinians. The pace of settlement increased steadily right through the 90s. Actually, the peak year was year 2000, Clinton's last year. Gaza was closed off, separated from the West Bank in violation of the Oslo Treaty. And that's been U.S.-Israeli policy since. I'll quote Amira Haas, one of Israel's leading journalists. She writes that the total separation of the Gaza Strip from the West Bank is one of the greatest achievements of Israeli politics, whose overarching objective is to prevent a solution based on international decisions and understandings, and instead dictate an arrangement based on Israel's military superiority. Meanwhile, repression intensified and Gaza was reduced to misery. Well, in 2005, came the famous disengagement. Israel had about 7,000 settlers illegally in Gaza, using a large part of the meager resources and land, maybe 30-40%, and defended by a big mass of the Israeli army. And General Sharon, who was prime minister, the most hawkish Israeli leader, he recognized rationally that it just made no sense to keep a small number of Jewish settlers in Gaza, which by then had been utterly devastated. It used to be a pretty wealthy place, but totally destroyed by then. So that was pointless. It made a lot more sense to take them out and send them to settle illegally in the West Bank, which Israel wants. So that was the disengagement. But you couldn't present it that way. So a farce was enacted. If Israel, they could have just done it very easily. They could have just said, on August 1st, the IDF, the army, is going to withdraw from Gaza. And at that point, the 7,000 or 8,000 settlers would have climbed into the lorries that were provided for them and be taken from their illegally subsidized homes in Gaza to their illegally subsidized homes in the West Bank. And that would have been the end of it. But that was no good. You had to have a PR operation. So what they staged is correct, was a confrontation. So you get front page newspaper pictures, of a little boy pleading with the army not to destroy his home and so on, and then the cries of never again, Holocaust. It was such a transparent farce that it was ridiculed in Israel. In January 2006, the Palestinians did carry out a major crime. Now, they had a free election, and they voted the wrong way. That's not allowed. The U.S. reacted instantly. Go back and look at the newspapers. Within days, the United States announced harsh punishment of the Palestinians. Israel, too, of course. Europe kind of went along as usual. In June 2007, Hamas, which won the election, there was a civil war in which Hamas drove out Fatah, the U.S. Favorites, and that showed that they're just a gang of terrorists. What actually happened is not contested. The U.S. Tried to initiate a military coup to overthrow the results of the elections. Now, that's standard operating procedure. The U.S. does that all over the world. So they tried a military coup. It was run by a Fatah strongman, Mohammed Dahlan. The coup was preempted by Hamas, and they drove out the Palestinian Authority, and they did take over. Well, that's the Hamas crime. Not that they're nice people. It's a harsh, brutal organization. I wouldn't want to live under their rule, but that's a separate story. And of course, the attacks then escalated again. The siege tightened. In June 2008, there was a truce call between Israel and Hamas. It's very important, actually. In 2008, there was a ceasefire, basically. So no Hamas rockets, and Israel would call off the siege. Notice, a siege is an act of war. Israel, of all countries, insists on that. Israel has launched two major wars, 56 and 67, on grounds that it was very partially blocked from the outside world through the Straits of Tehran. A total siege is, of course, an act of war. So the terms of the truce were Israel would call off the siege, Hamas would stop rockets. Well, Hamas lived up to that 100%. You can read it in the official U.S. Israeli records. They concede that during the period of the truce, there wasn't a single Hamas rocket. Israel never accepted the truce, maintained the siege. That was June 2008. In November 2008, the day of the U.S. election, you know, when everybody's paying attention to that, Israel invaded Gaza, sent in troops, killed half a dozen Hamas militants, and then rocket firing started again. And it went up and back. There were all the deaths, as usual, were Palestinian, but it did continue until December. In late December, Hamas offered to renew the truce. The Israeli cabinet considered it and rejected it. They had a choice then. They could have had a truce, no rockets. They would have had to weaken the siege. But they decided to reject it and instead invaded Gaza with U.S. support. That was the December 2008, January 2009 invasion, which you know about or should. The U.S. supported the invasion, as always, U.S. weapons. U.S. intervened at the U.N. to prevent a ceasefire. Obama had been elected, but he hadn't taken office. But he wouldn't say a thing about it. His line was, there's only one president, so I can't say anything. President is Bush. He was saying things about all kinds of other topics, like the Pakistani terrorism and so on, but couldn't say anything about this. The attack was very carefully calibrated so that it would end hours before the inauguration. And it did. That saved Obama the necessity to say anything about it. Now he was the one president, so he could give the usual story about let's forget about the past and look forward to the future and so on. Very convenient story for those who hold the clubs. Others don't like it much. Right after that, Obama gave his first and, in fact, only major speech on Israel-Palestine. It was an interesting one. He made one good move. He appointed George Mitchell as his negotiator. However, he immediately undercut it by making it clear that Mitchell would have no authority. The way he did that was clever, clever enough so that the press and commentators could pretend they didn't understand it. He said, there's now a great chance for peace. We ought to move forward for peace, you know, peace process. He says, there's a constructive plan on the table, the Arab peace plan. He said, finally, the Arabs have come along with the plan. Actually, they came along with it in 1976, but let's forget about that. But now the Arabs have come along with a plan. And their plan calls for normalization of relations with Israel. And he called on the Arab states to move forward with their plan and normalize relations with Israel. Well, you know, Obama is an intelligent, literate person. He can read, Harvard degree, and so on. He knows perfectly well that that's not what the plan said. The plan reiterated the international consensus on a two-state settlement and went even beyond it. It said, once that's established, we should move on to normalize relations with Israel. Well, Obama carefully omitted the guts of the plan and said, normalize relations with Israel. Now, that's his way of telling the world, we're not going to do anything. We're going to block peace, which is exactly what it meant and exactly what happened. Settlement expansion continued. Obama claimed to be opposed to it, but he made it very clear to Israel that the opposition didn't mean anything. He was asked, his spokespeople were asked at press conferences, are you going to do anything if Israel violates your demand to end settlement expansion? He said, no, this is just symbolic. In other words, Mr. Netanyahu, go ahead and do whatever you like. Meanwhile, George Mitchell was kind of displaced by Dennis Ross. Ross comes straight out of AIPAC. He was Clinton's negotiator. His position, as he says, is there's an asymmetry between Israel and Palestine. Israel has needs. Palestine only has wants, so therefore we can dismiss them. That's the neutral negotiator. He's now the leading advisor. Then comes a series of steps up to the veto of the UN resolution last February. The Arab League, meanwhile, they do talk. They don't say much, but they do say some things. Like a couple of months ago, they called for two no-fly zones. You heard about one of them. They called for a no-fly zone in Libya, and a big uproar about that. Great, no-fly zone in Libya, we got to bomb Libya because the Arabs demand it. They also, at the same time, called for a no-fly zone over Gaza. That no-fly zone over Gaza didn't conform to U.S. policy, so therefore that one didn't exist. Let's go on to what the options are now. Well, and there's a lot of commentary about this, of course, and the way it's usually phrased is that there are really two options. The one is the two-state settlement, which has been the international consensus for 35 years. You know, you can argue about this and that detail, but the base framework of it is understood. Now, that's one. And the other option that's proposed is that Israel should take it all over, take over the whole territory, and then there'll be a civil rights struggle, like kind of an anti-apartheid struggle. And actually, that's a position which is argued for by a lot of supporters of the Palestinians. They say that would be even better than two states, because then we could have an anti-apartheid struggle. Now, that's a real delusion. Those are not the two options. There's a third option. The third option is that Israel and the U.S. will continue doing exactly what they're doing right now. What they're doing right now is implementing a version of what used to be called the Sharon plan, after General Sharon, you know, big expansionist. And namely, Israel takes what it wants in the West Bank. And we know what it wants. It's not a secret. It wants everything behind the separation wall, which is in fact an annexation wall. Now, that's arable land, water resources, the nice suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and some big highway system connecting them and so on. So they'll take that. And they'll take what's called Jerusalem, which is far bigger than anything that was ever called Jerusalem. They've illegally expanded Jerusalem, illegally annexed it over Security Council orders. So they'll take Jerusalem, which cuts out a big piece of the West Bank. And they'll take the Jordan Valley, from which Palestinians are being mostly evicted and settlements are being set up. Now, that imprisons what's left. It's separated from Gaza, so no outlet to the sea or anything like that. And then they're cutting the corridors through what's left. There's a big corridor that goes east of Greater Jerusalem, goes almost to Jericho, essentially bisects the West Bank, a big town, Maal Edumim, being built there, mostly under Clinton, though it started in the 70s. Another corridor up north, it goes through Ariel, another town. Another one above that goes through Kedumim, still another town. It's essentially, you know, breaks the remaining parts of the West Bank up into almost non-contiguous and unviable cantons, a big infrastructure project so that, you know, Israelis and American visitors can drive through the whole area, you know, never even seeing a Palestinian, maybe some figure on a hill, you know, with a goat or something. Tourist office probably funds them, you know, looks good. But that's it. And the Palestinians can just rot. Not entirely. So like in Ramallah, the U.S. And in fact, Europe mainly, are funding a kind of an island of affluence. So you live in Ramallah, you know, you have nice restaurants, concerts, and so on. That's the standard neocolonial program. You go to any third world country, any miserable colony, you can find islands of affluence and glamour and so on beyond what we have. That's for the elites, and that shuts them up. And meanwhile, the rest just collapses. They can leave if they want. Well, that's the third option. And that's the one that's being implemented. So we don't have to speculate about it. It's being implemented. You're paying for it, or your parents, if you're not old enough to pay taxes. And that's what's going on before our eyes. So that's the real option. And the choice is that or two states. There is no third option at this point. You can think in the longer term, you know, maybe down the road there'll be something better, but there's got to be a first step, and the first step is two states. There's no other proposal. It's now argued very commonly that that's impossible. The settlements have gone so far that it's impossible. Well, the world doesn't agree. That's why you had the February resolution. The world thinks it's possible. The Palestinians think it's possible, both factions, Fatah and Hamas, which again reiterated its support for it. So I think there's reasons to believe it is possible. What's crucial is, as always, what the U.S. will do. If the U.S. joins the world, it'll be possible, and Israel will go along because they don't have any choices. And we can do things about it, like we can stop participating in the crimes. That's not a major, unimaginable action. Stop participating in the crimes, along with what, say, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and others are calling for, that would make a difference. It's very common now these days to draw analogies between Israel and South Africa. There's one analogy between Israel and South Africa which is very real and never discussed, probably because it's real. Around 1960, the South African nationalist government, it recognized that they're becoming an international pariah. And the South African foreign minister called in the American ambassador. We have the documents now. And he talked to him. He said, look, we're getting voted down by everyone in the UN. Now everyone's opposed to us and so on. But you and I both know that there's only one vote in the UN, yours. So as long as you're with us, we don't really care what the rest of the world thinks. And that's pretty much what happened. If you look through the following decades, by the 19th, a big anti-apartheid movement did develop. By around 1980, American corporations were pulling out. The Congress was passing sanctions. The UN had already declared an embargo. Nobody was supporting apartheid. It was overwhelming opposition. But the only person who was supporting apartheid was Ronald Reagan and his administration. They were strong supporters of apartheid, and they continued to support it in the framework of the war on terror. War on terror was declared by Reagan, not Bush. They had to defend the African nationalist apartheid regime against the terrorist Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress. And I mean it literally. In 1988, the White House declared the ANC, Mandela's ANC, to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. So, of course, we had to support the white nationalist regime. And that continued until around 1990. At that point, U.S. policy changed. Mandela was let out of Robben's Island. A couple of years later, apartheid was gone. It's not a nice situation. It's a pretty rotten situation in many ways, but at least apartheid was dismantled, which is a big victory. Now, that's not the only time that that's happened. There's case after case. When the boss lays down the law, people have to do something. You know, that's actually an optimistic conclusion for us. It means that it's really very much in our hands. If we take the right kinds of actions, If our own society is democratic enough so that popular opinion makes a difference, which it should be, and if it isn't, we have a lot to worry about, not just this, then plenty of things we can do to change that, to compel the United States to join the world on this issue as well as others. And in that case, this Israel-Palestine conflict can be certainly mitigated, not solved, but mitigated and set on the basis to a much more favorable outcome.
Mm-hmm. You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on the United States and Israel. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at UCLA in 2011. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. He's the author of many books, including The Essential Chomsky. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on the United States and Israel, and for his book, The Essential Chomsky, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Protect your keys? Simply attach a Waramps key tag to your key ring. If you lose your keys, the finder can call the number on the back of the tag or drop them in any mailbox, and the Waramps will return them to you by courier for free. Today, the key tag service is more important than ever with the high replacement cost of keys and remote devices. Waramps key tags, they're free and they work. Order yours at waramps.ca and help make a difference in the lives of amputees.
Hello, this is Boris Chassaigne. To get a feel on what's happening across the country, listen to Viewpoints. For reports, interviews, and documentaries on politics, arts and culture, the environment, housing, and more. Thanks to 30 journalists stationed in the Canadian provinces and territories. Local news nationwide. Mondays at 4:30 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM and streaming online at cjsf.ca.